We made this.
Welcome to One Rules Them All, a Lord of the Rings podcast for the We Made This podcast network. I'm your host, Baz Greenland, and joining me in this adventure across Middle-earth is my co-host in his expedition, Luke Winch. Luke, how are you?
Hello, Baz. I'm very well, thank you. I'm looking forward to digging into the second film, Two Towers.
Absolutely, yes. So before we get into the debut of Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power, September on Amazon Prime, we're looking back at all three of the movie adaptations of Lord of the Rings. So as you said, last month we took a look at my favourite movie, The Fellowship of the Ring, and this time we returned to 2002's The Two Towers. So I think you've already said in the last one, but where does Two Towers rate amongst all the other Middle-earth movies for you?
I think I mentioned last episode, by a hair's breadth, this is my favourite of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but only by a hair's breadth. I mean, I love all three of them. It's so hard to choose, but there are just elements that I absolutely adore about the Two Towers. I think the Rohan society itself, just all their culture and everything, is a big draw for me because I love that. You know, it's basically Vikings on horseback, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So that's the kind of stuff I really, really love. And it has the Battle for Helm's Deep, which I still think is the best kind of combat battle out of all three films.
Yeah, I was watching it again yesterday. I mean, I didn't need to watch this movie. I could talk about it in my sleep. But I was watching it again yesterday. Well, in two halves, actually. Yeah. Couldn't quite fit it in one go. But I watched all the Battle of Helm's Deep yesterday. And it's just staggeringly, staggeringly good. There is nothing, I think, as good as that. I mean, as much as I love the stuff in the third film, like the Siege of Gondor and that, I think nothing still beats Two Towers, the Helm's Deep, for me.
No, it's just, I mean, we'll get into it in more depth, but it is just, because it's quite close quarters combat, and there's obviously, you know, if you watch the documentaries, you know that they built a huge set, and they used a lot of model work to kind of attach to the long range shots. It's just the way it's so tactile and visceral, and, you know, six weeks or 8 weeks of night shoots.
It was a lot. Yeah, it was. Got it here. Looking at the quotes, it was. Well, they filmed 20 hours of footage over a 4 month period.
Four months,
I think
that's right.
Most of that. Yeah, 4 months to shoot with 3 months at night and 1 month of day shooting as well.
Yeah.
And there is like a 10-hour. Helm's Deep battle out there, you know, to be shown. So yeah, it's epic.
Yeah, I think on one of the documentaries, I think there's a like an hour long documentary on just the stunt team and what they did for those scenes. And apparently there is just hours and hours and hours of stunt work, and everyone's just like, "Yeah, we want the stunt version of Helm's Deep."
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it briefly, didn't we, on our Fellowship podcast? But the on the extended versions, you know, whether you want to watch the extended versions or not, and we'll talk about it in a second. The amount, the extras, the hours and hours of extras are as good as the movies themselves. They're so rich, so in depth. There's so much amazing stuff, down to all the, you know, the creation of the costumes and the armor and the stunt work and development from script to screen. It's staggeringly, staggeringly good. You can get lost in hours and hours and hours of this behind the scenes stuff across the movies and The Hobbit as well. So yeah, they're definitely, I mean, they alone are kind of make those deep. Well, I haven't been DVD and obviously, and they alone is why they're like some of the best discs I own, because of the extra work as well.
Yeah, I think there's one documentary on the Two Towers which is literally just about the horses used and how particularly Viggo got very, very attached to his horse, the horse that played Bregor in the film. And I actually think he bought it.
He did. He did. So when they had to do reshoots, he actually had the halls brought back to New Zealand because he was at. Yeah. So I mean, there's very close bonding with them, everyone who filmed it, obviously even down to the horses as well. So absolutely, it's fantastic. Mm. So what are your memories of watching this movie for the first time?
I think this is the film I went to the cinema the most to see, but I went to see it first time with my mum because my mum's a big Lord of the Rings fan, and I went to see all three films with her. And yeah, this one, I was always looking forward to this one because I love the Rohan, and it was just seeing them on screen for the first time, all in their armour and on their horses, and seeing Edoras. Yes. Seeing Edoras for the first time on that hill and knowing it was a legitimately built set was just stunning to see on screen. And then, of course, I mean, Helm's Deep and all the kind of build up to the battle as well was so kind of moving. And of course, you know, each film had to have an emotional ending, and it was interesting how they ended this one with Sam's speech at the end at the. At the window in Esgiliath, and it was just I remember, because I cried at all the movies, and I remember this one being particularly moving because I think at the time I wasn't going through such a great time, and it was that, and the story that Sam tells about, you know, there's good in this world and you just have to look for it, and all that kind of sentiment I thought was particularly moving for me at the time. So that's the kind of memories that imprint on me.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, with the first movie, I saw it with a big group of friends. I was still at uni for the first one, the Fellowship, and I'm the opposite of you. You know, Fellowship beats Two Towers by a hair's breadth. I think maybe the pacing is slightly better, and I love the Black Riders, but Two Towers is amazing. And see it on the big screen, just absolutely blown away. I went to see this with a friend who wasn't massively into Two Towers, but I couldn't wait to. I was away. I think it was my final year of uni, but I wasn't actually. I was away at Christmas, away from friends. I got gone back home, so I wasn't going to wait to go and see it with my friends in like a few days' time. So I was like, right, we're going to Two Towers. We're going to see it right now. And he loved it too. He was like, oh, I want to fight something now. You got really rolled up with the Helm's Deep stuff. But yeah, just seeing it there. And again, like the Fellowship, I watched it about three times at the cinema, and every single time, and even now, even yesterday, that stuff like Helm's Deep and that Sam's speech just really gets to you. It's powerful stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And it was also great. And, you know, we're going to talk about it soon. It was also great to have the new additions to the cast as well and what they brought to the film. And because in the first film, you primarily got the Fellowship of Nine, and then of course you go and see the elves at Rivendell and at Lothlorien. But now we've got much more of the world of men, the world of humans, and it was just a different vibe, a different tone to the movie, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, completely different, yeah. So before we dig a little deeper into what we think about Two Towers, a few details about the movie. So as with The Fellowship of the Ring and Return of the King, it was directed by Peter Jackson and co-written by Jackson, Philippa Boyens and Fran Walsh. It was released in December 2012, which of course means it's 20 years old this year, but I remember it like it was yesterday.
Yep, 100%.
Yep. So first question then for you. So obviously, I think I know your answer already. It's probably the same as mine. Theatrical or extended version?
I mean, do we have to ask ourselves these questions?
Extended version should know by now, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, The Fellowship of the Ring, I think the extended scenes are really, really important, particularly the gift-giving scene, because those gifts are used in later films. So that's a scene that I think is vital to it. The scenes that they add into The Two Towers, I think... most of them you didn't have to put them back in, but it just adds that adds that extra depth to certain character moments. It gives the film a bit more richness. Yes, the tone is a little bit more wobbly than The Fellowship, like you just said, but I think just having those extra scenes and having those character moments, I mean, just for instance, there's a bit more of Eowyn, there's a bit more of Eomer. There's just, you know, little kind of character moments that we didn't get in the theatrical version. And I mean, I love Eomer as a character, so I liked seeing a bit more of him in the extended editions, and it was nice to see, you know, there's extra bits in Helm's Deep. There's also a lot of extra bits with Treebeard and the two hobbits as well. So whether you're a fan
you watch it, and things like the Treebeard, when you watch the extended version, you see little bits, they kind of intercut a lot of stuff around the build up to and including Helm's Deep, and you can kind of see why they cut some of them, because the pacing's tighter. I think the theatrical version is tighter than the extended version. But, agreed, as you said, I think I'd always watch the extended version. All three films, to be honest, you know. Mm-hmm. Over 4 hours of Return of the King doesn't daunt me at all. You know, I'd watch 5 hours of Lord of the Rings. But it's but yeah, it's all the little moments, lots of little moments. And this one, you know, when you look at the extended version, you look at how many scenes, there are lots more expanded or brand new scenes put into the movie for the extended version than ever was in The Fellowship. The Fellowship was a little bit of contextual stuff that added to character, particularly Aragorn's character, whereas in Two Towers it's really fleshing out a story. There's some really lovely moments as well in this, which are kind of important, and particularly important to the overall story when you've watched all three films back to back as well. So how successful do you think Jackson and co were in adapting The Two Towers for the big screen?
I think it's the hardest of the books to adapt, and they talk about this actually on the documentaries, because it's the middle film, it's the middle child, it's always going to have a harder job of having a start, middle and end than say The Fellowship and The King, because The Fellowship's got the beginnings, The Return of the King's got all the epilogues and stuff. So the middle one, I think, was always the toughest to kind of adapt. And you know, there's quite a few changes from the book that I think a lot of people had trouble with. I think the main one being Faramir. Now, the change they did with Faramir, I actually agree with, because I think it actually makes more in-world sense. Because basically, in the book, he basically turns down the ring in a flash. You know, he just turns, you know, I will not take it, blah, blah, blah. He is, you know, he's a man, he's human, and humans are flawed and they are viewed as weak because they can be corrupted easily. The fact that both Gandalf and Galadriel are tempted by the ring makes no sense whatsoever that Faramir should not be tempted by the ring. So the fact that they actually make Faramir tempted in the movie, I think, actually fits in better with the rules that kind of govern the magic of Middle-earth. So yeah. I actually agree with that change, but I do know a lot of people had trouble with it. My mum still doesn't agree with it, even though I say to her, yes, but listen to me. It's the rules. It's applying the rules. But she doesn't like it. But I think it makes much more sense than what...
And it's not overt either. It's not like he's not as corrupt as Boromir. He's not at all. But and I think particularly, and we'll come on to it, the Sons of the Steward scene, where you see the flashback to Boromir and his father, which was completely cut from the theatrical version. Again, I can kind of see why it's probably cut, but that adds a lot of context to it, you know, trying to please his father. Also, that plays into Return of the King as well. Yes. Makes his temptation... It's almost like it's half a little bit temptation because the ring is so powerful, and half because it's his chance to prove himself to his father, which isn't really apparent in the theatrical version, because you don't even meet his dad, Denethor, until the third film. When you have the Sons of the Steward scene, which shows immediately that Boromir is a favourite son and Faramir can do no good with his father, the idea that actually his father wants the ring as his powerful weapon against Mordor, and he has a chance to do that and prove himself, shows actually, you know, I think that makes it more believable, that he, in one sense, the ring it will easily corrupt, and if Galadriel can be corrupted by the ring and a little bit tempted by the ring, as can Gandalf, then surely just a standard man can be corrupted. And secondly, the fact that it's also an opportunity to prove himself, that favourite son of Gondor, particularly as his brother's dead at this point as well, makes total sense. I agree. I don't think he's not the level of corruption that happens with Boromir. Boromir is basically corrupted straight away, whereas Faramir is a little bit tempted. I think there's a big difference between the two.
Yeah, I mean, the one scene that I think kind of encapsulates his temptation is when he confronts Frodo in the caves of the waterfall, and he uses his sword, doesn't he, to kind of pick out the ring from underneath his thing, and he goes, you know, the ring of power within my grasp. So at that moment, he is tempted, but the difference is between him and Boromir is that he truly starts to understand the power of the ring by the end, and he knows that he has to let Frodo go, and that makes him a better man than Boromir was, and that's the whole kind of conflict, isn't it, between Faramir and his father.
Yeah, definitely. I think as well with the adaptation of the second one, it's tricky as well, because not only is it the middle book, but also Jackson chooses to cut the opening and closing elements of the book completely from this film.
Yeah.
So the death of Boromir happens at the end of the Fellowship, which makes perfect sense. That big climax of his death is a heroic final stand. It absolutely works as part of the Fellowship. And then you've got Shelob, which is this terrifying spider. And I remember thinking, oh, I've got another year to wait. And I was disappointed I had to wait a whole year for Shelob, because I was really looking forward to Shelob. But it makes perfect sense, because it really shows the... Because as well, those who maybe aren't as familiar with the books or haven't read them for years and years and years, Two Towers is basically two books in one. It's all what's going on with Merry and Pippin and Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas, all the stuff in Rohan. And then that's basically book one. And ends with the Battle of Helm's Deep as halfway through the book, and then suddenly you switch to and here's Frodo and Sam at the beginning again and follow their journey, which goes through into Shelob and in the book. And so when you've got a half book purely focused on Frodo and Sam, Shelob is a great climax. But when you're merging the two, as you have to, and I think it's absolutely the right decision to have Frodo and Sam's story run alongside the others on film, because it wouldn't make sense to suddenly... Helm's Deep finishes halfway through and suddenly we switch to Frodo and Sam's journey. Wouldn't make sense at all as a film adaptation, unless you were going to do two books, even then, two films. Even then, probably doesn't make a lot of sense. So the fact that actually Jackson had to remove two big dramatic scenes from the book and still make it as good as it is the testament of how good this adaptation is. I think in some ways it's one of the best adaptations, because it changed a lot of stuff, but the way it focuses on the flood of Isengard with the Ents, again, which isn't really seen so much. You see it's more brought to life. And, of course, the climax of the Battle of Helm's Deep, that moment when Gandalf and Emma and that Warhol are here and ride down and they meet out in battle, is so big and so epic. Yeah. And it's the perfect climax for the movie.
Théoden King stands alone.
Not alone.
Rohirrim!
If you look at it chronologically, when Frodo and Sam are climbing Cirith Ungol up to Shelob's lair, I think it's mentioned in the book, they look across over to the direction of Minas Tirith, and the battle for Minas Tirith is just beginning. So actually, chronologically, having Shelob during the Battle of Minas Tirith makes much more chronological sense.
Yeah.
Because I think in the Two Towers, Aragorn and Co's story is a little bit more behind... When you finish the Two Towers, they're a little bit behind chronologically than where Frodo and Sam are at that point.
Yeah. Well, what they do then instead, they obviously bring in the stuff with Osgiliath. Osgiliath, again, isn't really seen, but they bring in they develop more of the Faramir stuff with the Osgiliath battle at the end, which, again, shows a kind of the fall of Gondor before you get to Minas Tirith as well. You see it in the distance. I think it was cut from the theatrical version. Apparently, Jackson cut the vision of the sight of Minas Tirith behind Osgiliath from the theatrical version, not to confuse with Helm's Deep.
Right.
You kind of see, you know, is that Helm's Deep in the background? You can see, but no. But it brings you back in for the extended version. But what he does very well, again, a lot along with the Sons of the Steward scene, which was obviously cut from the theatrical version, it really shows Gondor and how it's fallen apart. Osgiliath is a ruined city when you first see it. It's been recaptured and then taken again, then it gets recaptured and taken over a couple of times over the course of the two movies. So I think it makes sense to kind of show that kind of the fall of Gondor happening around them as well. And give, yes, it does create an extra bit of plot for Frodo and Sam, rather than parting ways and then going to Minas Morgul, but I think it still works quite well.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think there's more changes to the Two Towers than there were with the Fellowship of the Ring. The Fellowship of the Ring cut out a lot, as we talked about, you know, the whole beginning chunk of the book, basically. But I think they kept a lot of it in, whereas the Two Towers it's changed bits around. It's made some additional stuff. It's even swapped characters' lines around and stuff. So, you know, to give... You know, for instance, Eowyn is given a lot more to do than she is in the actual book, which we can talk about later. But it is, I think, if you look at the stuff they've had to do to adapt and change things around, I think it's probably one of the most kind of manipulated books onto screen out of the three films.
So let's look then at some of the kind of the new characters there. And we've already talked about him, David Wenham as a Faramir. What do you think of his performance?
Yeah, he's great. I mean, at the time, I think he's an Australian actor, I believe. I didn't know him at the time, but I think it was great. I mean, physically, he is the perfect match to be the brother of Boromir. I mean, him and Sean Bean share quite a few similar facial traits, so he was great. Yeah, I really liked him, and I liked that even though he appears menacing at the beginning, because we're kind of looking at it from Frodo and Sam's point of view, and when they first interact with him, he can appear quite menacing, and the way the camera kind of looms up. But he has this way of... Yes, he looks menacing, but he has a very kind face, and I think that slowly, like, transforms through his performance when he slowly starts to understand and kind of feel sorry for Frodo and understand the situation he's in. And I think that transformation, I think he does very, very well. And by the end, we kind of get the Faramir that we're going to see in the third film, which is a very... He's a very honourable man, and a very, you know, he's a man of valour and honour, and I think he has more of that than actually Boromir and his father, much more than Denethor. So, you know, and it kind of makes... I think in the book, he actually becomes the steward of Gondor whilst Aragorn's away. He basically becomes a very important person.
Yeah.
Chronicling the kind of story of what happened at Minas Tirith, and of course he ends up marrying Eowyn as well.
Eowyn, so. Yeah, definitely. I always like. I didn't think it was. It didn't blow. It doesn't blow me away. It's a much more slower, subtle performance. He's a good heroic character, but I think he serves it well. You know, when I think about some of the best performances in the Lord of the Rings movies, Wenham probably isn't going to be top of my list. But no. I think he does the... I mean, there aren't bad performances. The worst performance you get are the kind of slightly cockney orcs. But again, that kind of works with the orcs anyway.
Yeah.
So I don't really have a problem with those weird voices and the way they speak and stuff. But no, generally is a good performance. And I think he certainly brings it all to this one. I think he gets enough in this movie to sort of... to show the difference between Boromir, but also similarities. But I think then he kind of shines... in the third movie when he's confronted with his father and kind of faced with the burden of duty and what happens there. Before we get onto all the characters from Rohan then, obviously the other big actor in this movie, the new one, is Andy Serkis as Gollum. And, I could ask, do you think he's a good performer? But I probably know the answer already. What are your thoughts on Andy Serkis' performance?
Oh my God, what can you say about Andy Serkis? Mm. I mean, I don't think Peter Jackson realised... what a stroke of genius it was to cast Andy Serkis as Gollum. Yeah. And if you watch the documentary on the kind of evolution of Gollum, everything got better, and all the ideas about the CG and about the mocap, it all stemmed from Andy Serkis's performance. Mm. They didn't want to lose his... Because not only was it an incredible vocal performance, I mean, we all know...
Oh, yeah.
You know, everyone does Gollum impressions now, but he, you know... That vocal performance is amazing, but what comes with the vocal performance, and you can't separate it because it comes with it, is the physical performance.
Yes.
And how he contorts and moves his body around. And
you can tell who is Gollum, who is Smeagol.
Yes.
That's what's amazing about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. And the fact that it was Andy's performance that drove the technology forward to try and get as much as his performance on screen is really testament to him as a performance actor. He's just incredible in this film. He really is.
Yeah, definitely. And I will want to talk about some of his scenes as well later on. But yeah, we'll get on to that. Obviously, then you've got the other kind of four main new cast members, really, all on the Rohan set. So you've got Miranda Otto as Eowyn, the kind of, which I think in the book is really the only female character. As you mentioned, Arwen has like one scene and that's it. And she does at the end of Marries Aragorn. And then they did some really good work for her in the last film. I know she's in this as well, but Miranda Otto obviously steps up as Eowyn, who will play a bigger part in the third movie. What do you think of her performance in Two Towers?
I really like Miranda Otto. I think she's really good as Eowyn. She gets across the fact that, you know, she's a strong, she's a feisty woman. But also, more importantly, she is probably the Lord of the Rings' only feminist character.
Mm.
And that comes across really well. I mean, there's an incredible speech she does when Aragorn asks, "What do you fear, my lady?" She says, "A cage. To stay behind bars until use and old age accept them and all chance of valour has gone beyond recall or desire." I mean, that is... If you think about when Tolkien wrote these books and the society that he lived in, which was a largely patriarchal society, to put that in, to put this really strong feminist character into this book and have that speech, I think is quite remarkable, actually, in the time that they were living in. And, you know, in the third film, when you have the "I am no man" and where she, you know, she's the one who kills the Witch King, it's a statement, and I think it's an important statement, even if he didn't realise it at the time.
Yeah, it's just great work, because you could say an Eowyn in this character is a character who's basically put upon by the male characters. You've got Wormtongue leering over her. She's Uncall, who refuses to see her for who she is. You know, she obviously has an attraction to Aragorn, and she kind of fawns over him a little bit as well.
A little bit too much in places, yeah.
Yeah, I agree a little bit. But... and also all the best, and it's all set up for the third film, because Eowyn absolutely shines in that third film. She is fantastic. Yeah. And so it could be a bit easy for her to be a little bit of a kind of wet fish of a character who then stands up for herself in the third film. But I think she actually holds her own. She's really, really strong. She has that kind of fierce energy about her. And I think, as you alluded to, sometimes there are moments with Aragorn when they kind of try to play out this slight... And I know there, I think that is in the book as well. It's been a while since I remember from the book, but I think she is attracted to Aragorn. So it kind of creates this kind of love triangle of Aragorn. Not that I ever really believe that he has any attraction to her. It's all very much one-sided. And I don't necessarily agree how in the third film and the book, and they do it in the film a little bit, is how suddenly, I'll marry off to Faramir, and that's assaulted. And there's a little bit of thing, but they kind of do it, they very subtly do it in the third film to say, yes, that's what happened, but I don't actually play it up, because it's a bit silly that, oh, no, here's Faramir, you can marry him instead, because that's what the book does. But in this film, there's a little bit play up too much on, I think, with her attraction to Aragorn, but then I think that I do love their scenes. I do really like their scenes together, and where she tries to understand him, and he's that person where she can express herself as well. And that's my part of the attraction. I think, you know, he recognises the strength in her as well a little bit, and she can stand up for herself. So I think Miranda Otto does a really good job of a character that actually isn't really going to get her moment in the limelight until the next movie. So, but doesn't make her a kind of a very demure character either, which she could have been.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I am very conscious that we are two men talking about
of course,
female feminist character. But, you know, I do, apart from the falling over Aragorn, I do think she is probably the most strong feminist character in the Lord of the Rings world. And I do love that first conversation between her and Aragorn, and that clashing of the swords. It's a statement in itself that she doesn't believe that she belongs as a wife or in the kitchen. You know, she wants to fight for her people and, you know, and be on the front line. So I think that's a great line.
What about Carl Urban as Eomer? Again, he's a character that very much shines in the third film and is actually only really in a few scenes. But what do you think of his performance in this movie?
I like Carl Urban. Again, I didn't know who he was until this movie. I think he's a New Zealander.
Yeah, I think it's the movie where he became quite big. I think it was around before then, but this is why I first remember Carl Urban.
Yeah, I can't remember. He is in the second Bourne movie, and I can't remember if that is before or after The Two Towers. So,
okay, yeah. Probably about the same time, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's great. I mean, like you just said, he doesn't have too much to do, really. He has that great scene where he encounters Aragorn, Legolas and Gimli. Love that scene. I think he's great. Yeah. He looks amazing in his armour as well. That's incredible armour that he wears.
Yeah, definitely.
It's interesting because his performance of AMA is very different from the AMA in the book. the Emma in the book's a little bit younger, where we've got a slightly older, gruffer version here. And I think Emma gets that across. You know, he's a kind of gruff head warrior of this kind of warrior society, and he gets that across really well. He's great when he's kind of confronting Wormtongue as well, and then he gets banished from the kingdom. And that's kind of the last we see of him, really. So, you know, he has very few scenes, but I think you really get a sense of who AMR is in those small scenes that he has.
Oh, definitely. It is all set up because, he turns up at the end with Gandalf at the end, and he's there in that final shot when they're looking towards Mordor. But he's very much, he's going to be a big character. But again, at least Eowyn gets a lot to do in this movie, even though it gets set up for the next one. Whereas, arguably, also, same with Theoden in a way, but at least Theoden gets to rally the troops at Helm's Deep. But I think Eowyn is very much a set up character, but he's only in a few scenes, but he certainly makes his presence known in this movie. Let's talk about Bernard Hill then as Theoden then.
Alas, that these evil days should be mine. The young perish and the old linger. That I should live to see the last days of my house.
Serdra's death was not of your making.
No parent should have to bury their child.
He was strong in life. His spirit will find its way to the halls of your fathers.
Bernard Hill, man. No one else in my mind could ever play Theoden. I think Bernard Hill is just... he's probably my favourite character in The Two Towers and my favourite performance. He plays... You know, he has to wear a lot of hats as Theoden here because, you know, when we first see him, he's the fallen king. He's weak. He's controlled by Saruman. He barely knows his own daughter. He barely knows his own cousin. And then once he's kind of free of the curse, we get much more of a sense of who he is. And he plays that, you know, he has strength, but he's kind of lost it. He's lost that ability to be strong, particularly after the death of his son, Theodred. There's some lovely scenes between him and Miranda. There's an even more lovely scene in The Return of the King, which we'll get to in that movie. But he has great chemistry with Miranda. He has great chemistry with Ian McKellen as Gandalf, and it makes those scenes just really touching.
Yeah, that scene when he's burying his son, where he talks to Gandalf, no father should ever bury his son, is such a powerful moment. Because it's not one of the biggest scenes in the movie, but it really resonates, and that's all down to Bernard Hill's performance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's wonderful. And then, you know, I like that slow rise of believing in himself again as a leader. Yeah. And Aragorn has a lot to do with that, so those scenes between them, I think, are really good.
Yeah. And then in the arrogance, because actually then it gets...
No
one says, is this it? You know, as soon as you say that, the wall explodes and all hell breaks loose at Helm's Deep. You know, there's a bit of arrogance in him as well, which I quite like. You know, he's broken and he gets that strength again. But actually, he's very pragmatic. He's very much, no, we're going to do this. Let's go to Helm's Deep because we can't defend from here. That's our only chance. No one's ever taken Helm's Deep. He's very kind of practical in his approach as well. But he's dealing with that grief for his own son. He's dealing with the fact that everything's fallen apart around him. His nephew has been banished. Wormtongue and Saruman have corrupted his kingdom, and now they're going to be wiped out. And then you get that kind of arrogance and strength that comes with him, which kind of is a little bit of his undoing at times, because it's pretty much a massacre at Helm's Deep until the end. But Bernard Hill, I agree. I think it's between Bernard Hill and Andy Serkis in very different ways as probably the two best players in this movie, really. And I guess Sean Astin, who really steps up as Sam as well. I think he's fantastic. The last character I probably want to talk about then to the new cast, really, is Brad Dourif as Wormtongue as well. Oh, he plays so many despicable characters on so many TV shows and films, but I think Wormtongue is just a piece of work and I love it.
Oh, it's just a wonderfully insidious performance, isn't it? He just... Uzi's creepiness, particularly in the scene with, I mean, the scene with him and Eowyn is just...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a great speech. And actually, that speech is Gandalf's in the book. And how they've turned that speech around in a different context and having Wormtongue say it to her is, one, a great bit of kind of writing and putting a different spin on it. And two, it's Brad's performance and the way he delivers that speech is just... just fantastic.
It's insidious. It's so insidious, it really and creepy. Is, yeah. And it's fantastic. Yeah, he's great. And I think his best scenes probably are in Edoras. And I think he's kind of good as a sort of sidekick to Saruman. He's someone for Saruman to sort of sound off on. And you know, he's one that comes up, that mentions the weakness in Helm's Deep and so on. I think in the third film, obviously, there's very little there. But yeah, I think the scenes in the way he stands up to Aragorn when they arrive at Edoras, the way he manipulates the king into exile in Eomer, and the way he kind of leeches over Eowyn as well. It's so creepy, but so well done. Yeah,
that's quite a funny story, that apparently he kept his English accent throughout the entire production, and then he broke into his American accent when it had finished. And everyone thought it was a fake American accent because he was absolutely convinced that he was British.
Yeah. Oh, so good. Absolutely. So let's move on then. We talk about the kind of the new cast members then. Are there any other performances that you kind of want to call out in the show, obviously from the returning cast as well? Anything that stands out for you?
I think you just mentioned some. I think, I think Sean Astin really steps up for this movie. He's got a lot more to kind of dig his teeth into because the conflict, the inner conflict of Frodo is starting to, fray at their relationship. So he has a bit more dramatic. And he also has, he has Gollum to bounce off of. And, so he's got a lot more emotional, dramatic stuff to do in this movie than he did in The Fellowship. And he really steps up and he's really, really good at it as well.
Definitely, yeah. He becomes the heart of Lord of the Rings. And by the third one, he kind of cements that absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, so no, I definitely agree with that as well. And I guess the other thing as well, I mean, I think everyone steps up. You know, there's really good stuff with Merry and Pippin and obviously with Treebeard. And I love the banter. I love that. It's much more than the extended version. They kept in Legolas and Gimli keeping count of the amount of orcs they kill in Helm's Deep as well. And that's great. The moments when in the friend of the battle, you hear 23, 24, isn't it? As they're killing as well. It's great. They're keeping count in the middle of this bloodshed, which is great.
Yeah.
And then Aragorn again steps up. So everyone kind of steps up in this movie. You know, you get a more sense of who Legolas, and like Legolas is good because they get more of the conflict with Aragorn at times. You know, these people are going to die, but I'm going to die with them. And that kind of creates a bit of divide, which is unexpected, but then really works. And you get some cool Legolas moments. I think there's the grabbing hold of the reins and flipping over the horse scene with the wargs. And then, of course, then there's surfboard shield down the steps, which is so ridiculous, but it's so cool at the same time. I love it.
It's so ridiculous, and I'm sure Tolkien turned in his grave. But it is a fun moment. It really is.
Yeah, they try and recreate it with the elephant thing in the third film, which I always felt like it's trying to outdo it, and I don't think it really beats the cool moments in this one. But there you go. But everyone steps up. Everyone.
I do think Merry and Pippin, and I'll probably touch upon this more in our favourite moments section. But I do love the stuff between Merry and Pippin, and this movie is a turning point for Pippin in his understanding of what's going on. And, I'll get to that in my favourite moments.
Yeah, Mary's a bit more clued on, and is that the end point where he realises, absolutely, yeah. So one thing I wanted to talk about then, before we talk about our kind of favourite moments as well, I think we talked about our kind of best performance. I think we've kind of established our best performance in the movie, but let's talk about the development of Rohan then, because we've talked a lot about it, but the way they built this whole new culture and developed the world, it's staggering to think that the entire Hall of Edoras is built from scratch, inside and out on that hill. Like, it wasn't there before, and because it was like a conservational area, it's not there anymore. It's like Hobbiton. It doesn't exist anymore. They built everything from scratch. And it's just absolutely staggeringly how good it looks.
It's almost ridiculous what they did to build that set. Because, like you said, it's a conservation range, so they had to get all the turf up and remove the turf, put it in a greenhouse, and just keep it alive whilst they were filming. And then once they basically ripped all the buildings down, gently put the turf and all the fauna and everything back to exactly where it was. So it's an insane thing to do to build a set, but my God, that set is incredible. And I don't think if you'd had any form of CG on that, and you had, you know, there's a shot of Eowyn, I think, on the top platform, and you just see the landscape, and you see the three horses riding foot. If any CG had been done that, you would nowhere near have got the effect you got of understanding that landscape and understanding where Adarys is.
No, absolutely not. And I think this is why I was watching the movie yesterday, and I was watching, and Jen was kind of in and out of the room, and I said to her, this movie looks so good. And she was like, yeah, I completely agree. And it's because it still stands up today that, the, you know, if there were a couple of shots with Gollum when I kind of thought, yeah, you can kind of see it. It's still really, really good. But because it's 20 years on and because technology's moved on, you can kind of go, okay, yeah, I can see a couple of things where it looks a little bit CGI, but it's still magnificent. You know, it's nothing to scoff about. But this movie is timeless. These movies are timeless. They look so good. I think this is where they fell down with the Hobbit movies. I think they were aged much more than the Lord of the Rings movies, because of things like Edoras and the Helm's Deep stuff, and all the other movies as well. They built the sets, the inside and out of the Edoras Hall just looks fantastic. It looks real. It looks rich, dark, and it's got some history to it. Everything down to the carvings and the drapes and everything. It's magnificent. And yeah, I think it's astounding that they built this set, but it just holds up so well. And then when you got things like all the armor as well, they built, you know, Eomer's armor looks fantastic. Mm. And they've got all the sword with the two horses around it. It looks old and aged and full of history. Everything about the Rohan, the Rohirrim culture has so much depth and so much richness to it that you would never get with CGI work or with kind of just, you know, fake computer graphics. You know, it's all real. The armor is real, the costumes are real, the sets are real, and it feels like you're walking into history when you walk into that Hall of Edoras.
Yeah, and you really understand as well that this society is all centered around their love of horses. I mean, all the armor's got all horse motifs. You can see it on the Golden Hall at the top. All the stables are on top of the hill with the Golden Hall above the citizens. So that is a symbolic kind of gesture of how highly regarded they hold horses in their society. And I love that little detail about it. And yeah, in the clothes and the weapons, there's all these horse motifs. And it's just it's really brilliantly realised culture.
Yeah, and it's for the is Alan Lee and John Ho, I think, the artist, because I've got their books and I've had those books for years. The Art of Tolkien, they came onto the film, and there was I think, I'm not sure which one it was, well, them who did a picture of Edoras decades ago, and it looks like Edoras in the movie. It's from a distance, and you see it, and it's just great. It's been brought to life. You see there. I mean, again, I think it was the Marshall Jackson to bring these artists, who had done fantastic work bringing the visuals of Tolkien's world to life in these pictures, and then get them on the set to actually use them to help build, you know, help design what we got on screen. Because, they get Tolkien's world, and Jackson gets Tolkien's world. And, I know obviously Jackson, I say Jackson as kind of the figurehead of all the production. You know, the amount of people involved in this movie is phenomenal. Being from the armor to costume to set design, and everyone involved really gets it, and it looks amazing. It looks absolutely amazing.
Yeah, and they made that set really practical as well, because all the houses and stuff basically acted as canteens and storerooms. You know, they basically could just stay there. One of the funny things about it was, though, apparently it was constant 60 mile an hour winds, because it was in a valley. And I think when they were scouting the location, they all went up the top of the hill, and Peter Jackson lost his glasses. They just whipped off his face. And you can tell, actually, in the shots with Eowyn, like, you know, coming out of the hall and standing on the kind of stone plinth, you can tell it's windy, because her dress is just literally flapping away like crazy, and her hair all over the place. So it must have been quite a physical place to act.
Mm. Yeah, definitely, yeah. Again, it makes it more believable when she walks out and you feel the wind, and the banner rips off. And so, it's very, very good. And of course, the Helm's Deep set as well is just, I mean, there's a lot of model work as well. But actually, the set, that kind of the fort set, where you see all the different levels and where Theoden looks out and stuff, it's fantastic. It looks real.
Yeah, Helm's Deep's amazing. And that was a mixture of real set, because they built it in a quarry. They basically just dug stone out of a quarry. And then it's kind of enhanced with a lot of model work. So there's not actually a lot of CG on that. It's all physical stuff, which again lends to the reality of the situation and just the look of it.
Yeah, I mean, again, you'll see in the third film with Minas Tirith, was the whole model of that. And again, it's real. But yeah, so when the wall explodes, and you see the whole...
That's a nuts shot, that is.
That is, it is incredible. And you watch it, and you these chunks of rock flying in the air and landing on the troops. You can hear it, you can feel it. Yeah. And again, because it's model work rather than CGI, it's got a bit more of a kind of grittiness to it. You know, it kind of feels more real again at the same time.
Yeah. Definitely, there is some CGI'd men and orcs, and I always notice one more extra in the explosion than I did the last time I watched it. It's like, oh, there's a new person flying away there.
Yeah, definitely. One really fun fact I was looking at today about the Uruk-hai, they couldn't recruit enough 6-foot men to play Uruk-hai, so some 5-foot high men were cast as well, and they were known as the Uruk-lo. Oh, that's a fantastic fact. Brilliant. Yeah, yeah. And apparently there were so many people involved in Helm's Deep, you know, so it went for 4 months, that all the extras and actors got t-shirts reading "I survived Helm's Deep," and apparently people walking around cities in New Zealand would cross people wearing the same t-shirt because that many people were involved in the Helm's Deep. Even with all the brilliant CGI work that he did do, that Weta Digital did with the armies, because there was a lot of obviously that as well for the armies.
Yeah.
But yeah, the amount of people involved who just all had the same t-shirt is great.
Yeah. And Viggo famously lost it. Well, his tooth came out during a take, and he basically just held his tooth up and went, "Has anyone got any super glue? Because I don't want to stop filming." And he basically super glued it into his, back into his gum, finished the scene, and then went off to a dentist and had it properly put back. But yeah, that man had dedication, I tell you.
Well, yeah, they were all injured. I think it was, where is it? I'm just looking now. Yeah, in the wide shots, we got Legolas, Aragorn, and Gimli right at the beginning, running after the orcs at the beginning. They were all injured. Orlando Bloom apparently broken some ribs, falling off a horse. Viggo Mortensen had broken two toes, kicking that scene when he kicks the helmet when they find the fire. And the Gimli stunt double, Brett Betty, had a knee injury. So when they're running, they're all really injured.
Yeah.
And apparently, they were so dedicated that apparently the screams of pain when they stopped filming was quite impressive. So yeah, that's dedication to the movie as well. The fact that, you know, they're all injured, but you wouldn't know it looking at this movie.
No, you wouldn't.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of our favourite moments. So we've talked about some of the performances and the design of Rohan and that. We'll talk about I'm particularly focused on the climax of the movie and all the Helm's Deep stuff. But generally, let's go for the movie. What are some of your favourite moments from the film?
Oh God, there's so many. I do like the Gandalf the White revelation when he appears in the movie. I love that ambiguity that you get at the beginning when you get the voices of Christopher Lee kind of being morphed with Ian McKellen's, and I love that ambiguity. And then you kind of have Gandalf stepping out into the light, and I really like his kind of his story of how he became the White and all that, and you know, the fight with the Balrog. I just love that scene.
Well, I want to talk about the opening of the movie as well. It's fantastic because it's the gorgeous sweeping shots of the mountains, and then you zoom into back to Moria from the first film, and then you follow Gandalf as he falls down fighting the Balrog into the depths, and obviously you find the heights of the mountains as well. It's an incredibly high octane opening to the film.
It's a great way of reintroducing you to the world by going back to a scene that you've already you've already seen in the previous film, but then seeing it from a different perspective because the camera goes down with Gandalf. And I think that's an absolute genius way of opening the middle movie, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's great because obviously the first one is obviously the big prologue. The third one is the Smeagol corrupt finding the ring. They're quite important. This one, there's probably very little you can get of real importance in this one. So the fact that they focus on that is a great way of doing that and bringing it back. Absolutely. What other scenes stand out for you?
I do like the first encounter with Smeagol. I love that slow creep down the cliff as Sam and Frodo are sleeping, or pretending to be sleeping, as it turns out. But just that first encounter with him, and you see him. You know, all you see is his backside, basically, but you hear the voice, you hear his hunger for the ring, and then you just get that lovely tug and tussle between those three. And it's also an introduction, actually, to how good the mocap and special effects are, because you've got Gollum interacting with lots of different things, like the cloak that he kind of spins, his foot spins around on it, and you get that physicality with it. So it showed, you know, not only was it a great introduction to the character, it showed this is what we're going to do with the CG mocap technology. This is how good it's going to be. And that is a great kind of way of introducing both those elements.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I'm going to shop straight. My favourite scene of the movie is not, okay, as much as Helm's Deep, I love, it's the Sméagol Gollum scene yes, towards the first movie, when they argue each other and then Sméagol wins out. It is incredible. The fact that it's CGI mocap performance of Andy, I mean, it shows how good Andy Serkis is. The way they debate each other, this kind of it's almost like a take on associative identity disorder. You should be known as multiple personality, and the kind of the way Jackson uses that, the idea of, I think it's one of the masterstrokes of the movies that wasn't really clear. In the, it's kind of there in the book, but not really made clear until the adaptation for the screen, is the dual personalities of Gollum and Sméagol, and they always felt to me like they were kind of merged into one. There was a little bit kind of really Gollum had won in the and it was like Gollum was kind of regressing to his earlier self as Sméagol. Whereas I think in the movies, what they do so well is have two personalities kind of fighting for attention.
Sneaky little hobbitses. Wicked, tricksy, fierce. No, not master. Yes, precious, fierce. They will cheat you, hurt you, lie. Master's my friend. You don't have any friends. Nobody likes you.
Not listening. Not listening.
You're a liar.
No.
Murderer. Go away. Go away! I hate you. I hate you. Where would you be without me? Ellen! Ellen! I saved us. It was me. We survived because of me!
It just blows me away of how good, how entertaining it is, how much you that triumph when Gollum wins through as well. It's great because you absolutely feel for Sméagol in this movie. And when he is betrayed by Frodo and Faramir, and you know, not say Frodo's fault, but obviously he is, and Gollum comes back at the end as well, you feel so sorry for Sméagol. And you wouldn't think a mocap CGI character in this movie would steal the show. And I think it seems like that when Sméagol particularly steals the entire film.
It's very important to get across to the audience that Sméagol is a good-natured person, and that Gollum is what the ring has done to him. And that scene gets that across in such a perfect manner, in a perfect way. And you do have to feel pity for him. I mean, it's said in the first film when Gandalf and Frodo had that conversation in Moria, it was the pity of Bilbo that stayed his hand. And it's the pity of Bilbo that basically leads to freeing Frodo from the ring at the very end, and Gollum going, you know, leaping off the cliff and dying with the ring. And if Bilbo had not had pity for Gollum, the story would have gone very, very differently. And I think it's very important that you do feel pity for Sméagol, and that you do know that there is a conflict within him created by the ring, the madness of the ring. And what it also does as well, and the film, the extended scene in the waterfall with Faramir shows us a little bit, is that Frodo is already starting to have the effects of the ring, and starting to have this other personality that is a nasty, selfish, snidey person. And Sam unfortunately does get some of the stuff from that nasty side of Frodo.
So definitely,
it's really important that you do that. And I think Andy Serkis, she's just amazing in that scene, and also the editing as well, because you get that the camera's switching back and forth, but he did film it in one take. He just turned his head and they just did the different things. And I like the editing towards the end of the conversation, because you actually slowly, you start to get the little turns of the head, because at first it's just one side, the other.
Yeah, it's very and clear different shots.
Yeah, and then as Smeagol's winning the argument, you get a slightly later take where he's turning his head. And I like the way they do that, because it's basically showing that he's becoming Smeagol again, or temporarily, of course, but he's starting to get there. And it's just, it's a brilliant piece of filmmaking, full stop.
It is, yeah. Any other scenes stand out to you?
We've got to talk about Aragorn's hero entrance when he comes back from falling off the cliff, and he just swings those double doors open. It's just that slow motion hero moment is just is brilliant. But I think all my other favourite moments are within the Battle of Helm's Deep, which I know we're going to talk as a big section. But I also love the entrance of Shadowfax.
Yes, it's so gorgeous, isn't it? Yeah, the way it appears.
Yeah,
it's funny you should mention the doors, because I did actually reach out on Twitter as well and ask, you know, people their thoughts on favourite moments as well. So, you know, we've had the whole Helm's Deep, the bit with the Nazgul appears with Frodo at the end as well. But I think it was, Jessica Trevino and Miss Gelly said, yeah, the bit, and showed the gif of Aragorn when he pulls over those doors, like hero moment at Edoras. It's like, yeah. it's
great.
It's great, it's like, so funny,
it's
yeah.
It's swagger, it's presence, it's charisma, it's just brilliant.
Yeah, and Katie Doe said, whoa, that bit, fire. So yeah, we definitely got that bit. Obviously, the Gandalf battle thing as well, and Aragorn and Brigo, yeah. So yeah, a lot of really good stuff there as well. And
Actually, one more favourite moment, and I completely forgot about it, but it's one of my favourite moments of the entire movie, is when Gandalf exercises Saruman out of Theoden, and you get that lovely transformation. I flipping love that bit. I love that moment. It's great.
Yeah. I'm going to throw one more in before we talk about Helm's Deep, then we'll talk about the climax of the movie and all the stuff that goes on with Isengard as well. The Dead Marshes. It's proper. This is Peter Jackson really indulging in horror then. It is really, really nasty. And those faces come at the water. It's like some kind of like a 1920s, 30s black and white horror movie, I think. The way they come out through the water, the really distorted faces of the ghosts of the people who died the battle there, as they come towards Frodo and try to drag him into the water. It is proper horror. I love it. I'm a massive horror fan. So yeah, that always resonates with me.
No, it's a really good thing. And in the book, it's a very dark, drudging, big section of the book. And actually, my grandpa, God rest his soul, whenever he did a reread, he would not read the Dead Marshes chapters because he found them really, really hard to read. Because they are, it is very dark and very dreary. And it's basically Frodo just descending in slowly into madness. And it's quite difficult to read. But I think they make it a bit more... Or Peter kind of, as you said, gets a bit more horror aspects into it, and it's a lot short. It's a lot more condensed than the book is, because they're in those swamps for flipping ages in the book.
Yeah, and of course you get the Return of the Black Rider on a freaking dragon as well. So yeah,
exactly.
I prefer them on the horses, but I think they look pretty cool as well and menacing on the flying beast as well. Yeah. So let's kind of, I say wrap up, we'll probably talk quite a bit about it as well then. I want to talk about some of the extended scenes as well, go a few of those briefly as well. But let's talk about the entire climax of the movie and all the stuff with Merry and Pippin and Treebeard and, of course, the Battle of Helm's Deep.
The one aspect of Helm's Deep which I think I love the most, and I love more than the battle, is the build-up.
Yes.
The how Jackson and the writers get this real sense of doom approaching, and you've got all the women and children in the caves, and they can hear the marching of the orcs through the ground, and that fear, and I love that. And then you've got that awesome scene where they're on top of the barricade, and all they can see is thousands and thousands of torchlights coming towards them, and it's just that sense of build up that you know the battle's coming is just such a brilliant piece of atmospheric filmmaking.
Yeah. And Bernard Hill's speech with the Where is the Horse and the Rider speech.
Yes.
That music, I mean, Howard Shore's music in this film is phenomenal.
Yeah.
I get the whole trilogy, but there's the haunting music, almost choir, kind of very haunting music he has. as Theoden speaks, and he's kind of like, he's not giving up, but he's kind of realizing this is the final stand. It's that shot as well of the kids being given the oversized helmet and the axe, these kids being dragged from their parents with these swords against these absolute monsters. And then, of course, you've got Aragorn, Legolas at odds as well. Everything about that build up is immense.
Yeah, and I think you really get a sense of Tolkien's understanding of war as well, particularly with that scene you just mentioned about, you know, World War One and World War Two. They basically enlisted kids who just turned 18, and that pitch, you know, that image of the child with the sword and the helmet is so kind of echoing those times when the young went to war and they wouldn't come back. And I think that's really Tolkien's, you know, haunted by the two wars that he lived through, and you really get a sense of that in Helm's Deep. And I think Peter Jackson really understood that and wanted those moments in the film.
Yeah, it's kind of inconceivable, the idea of a 14-year-old going to war. You know, my kids are 15 and 16, so the idea of them being alone themselves, I always remember I went in my first couple of years after primary school. I was in grammar school, and they had this grammar school was, you know, been around for hundreds of years. And they had in this big hall they'd built in the 50s, and it was a memorial hall to the kids who had died in the war. And it's all these kids from like 14, 15-year-olds who had died, gone to the war and died. And it always, I could never kind of understand, kind of comprehend what that actually meant, because the idea, you know, these were kids a year or two older than me who went to war and died. And I could never really understand it. And you're right, you know, you see scenes like that, and obviously I could never understand it, but I can feel that palpable tension, horror and fear and desperation, you know, in those kids. You know, it's interesting, we look at the amount of people that survive at the end. There aren't that many people left when Theoden makes his final stand. So, you know, these people don't survive, and it's horrible and to watch. But, you know, you get a sense of these... of, you know, husbands and sons being dragged away from their families. You know, they say farmers and thatchers and all these people who have never actually seen war, who are dragged away against an army that is purely bred to eliminate them. And, you know, the best fighters in the world, I think. And it's the amount insurmountable, and you really, really get that.
Yeah, and also what's really important in those scenes, particularly with a kid, is Aragorn starting to face the fate that waits for him, and stepping up to be a leader and a leader of men, and that lovely speech that he gives the kid, you know, there is always hope, even though he may not believe that himself at that point. It is about giving your people, your troops, hope, because otherwise what else is there to fight for?
Yeah,
and that is definitely Aragorn stepping into his role as a leader and a king, and definitely. I love that.
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think of the arrival of Haldir and the elves from Lothlorien then? Did that work for you?
Yeah, it did. It's different from in the book. It's the Dúnedain that actually arrived. But I love the fact that we have the elves, and I love the fact that they bring Haldir back, because you get that lovely connection that you got from the first film with Aragorn and Haldir.
Yeah.
So I think it was a great choice to have them. And it's just like, you know, at that point there is so much despair going on among the people, and, you know, everyone's just looking at this approaching giant orc army, and they just think they're going to die. And that glimmer of hope is these beautiful golden armor clad elves coming up, and everyone starts to believe that they actually might be able to defend Helm's Deep and carry on living.
Definitely. And it reminds you of the opening prologue again, that the armor is very similar to the elves from the prologue.
Yes.
That sense of kind of history repeating itself as well. It's a lovely moment of hope as well. I guess it also makes the movie slightly more believable. They hold on as long as they do as well, because actually the elves are pretty badass as well, and kind of hold their own as well. Definitely. The original plan, I think, in the first earlier drafts, was actually Arwen was going to turn up. And it was going to be Arwen, and she was going to bring Aragorn the sword that Eldor brings him in the third movie, the cut the ring that will be reforged in the third movie. And Arwen was going to turn up, because it was maybe to give, probably recognising that there weren't many female characters in this movie, and particularly in this movie, Eowyn doesn't get to fight in this movie as well. So I can kind of see the temptation of expanding what they did with Arwen in the first movie and having a fight in this one, but would that have worked for you?
No, not in the slightest. I am so glad they did not go down that road. I know that they even filmed scenes with Liv Tyler there on set, and they filmed a lot of scenes. And I think they realise that the best way to use Liv Tyler is to basically just remind us of Aragorn and Arwen's relationship. Mm. And they do that really clever. I like the way they do it, actually. They do it through almost like a psychic connection between them both and thinking about memories of them together and stuff like that. So I really like the way they do it. I think it's a really touching, moving way they do it. I just think having Arwen at the Battle of Helm's Deep, I just think it's a stretch too far, going too far away from the material that they have. And I'm really glad that they kind of went back to the book material a lot closer than they would have.
Yeah, I agree. I think it may be an adaptation too far. I understand the temptation to do it, to bring a stronger female character in, but I don't think it would have worked. So yeah, I think I like that they bring Haldor. They bring a character that you recognise from another movie, who then when Haldor dies, it has some resonance. You know, not probably masses, because we've only seen him in a couple of scenes before, but there's enough of there. The fact that he comes there with a hope and that kind of the way we're now gone hugs him and you're most welcome. It's you know, it's a moment of hope. So to kill Haldor in the battle is quite sad, but it's it has a little bit of resonance, certainly.
And you get that important connection as well with the fact that if Aragorn doesn't come back, you know, Arwen will die because her fate is tied to the ring, as her father Elrond says. And you get that scene with Elrond where, you know, there's quite a bit of tension going on because he wants her to come back with him and she wants to stay here and become mortal with Elrond. So
yeah,
I like the way they use Arwen better in these scenes than if they would have brought her back and made her a fighting elf.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. So what about the battle itself then? What moments really stand out for you in the battle?
I love, oh God, there's so many bits. I love poor Gimli can't see over the battlements and Legolas going, would you like me to get you a box? Great moment. I love the first kind of wave of arrows going over and how that all works and with the elves behind it. And also, you know, the tension's built up so well because you get them all standing there and you get the orc army standing there. And you got that shot of Theoden and they're all waiting, and then you'd get that pitter patter pitter patter of rain, and the rain starts, and then you just get Theoden going, so it begins, and it's just chaos. It just chaos resumes, and it's just the build up and the way it's the pacing. Even though the pacing of the entire film isn't great, the pacing of Helm's Deep is pitch perfect.
It is. And then of course he goes, is this it? Enter the guy with the orc with the gunpowder, and it just all goes to shit basically at that point in the movie.
It really does.
Yeah, and it's great. There's a real sense of desperation. You know, you got Haldor dying. Yeah, you got Legolas and the surfboard shield, but I think that's quite a cool one. There's some fun stuff with Gimli and Legolas in there. You know, stuff like Aragorn going badass. I love the kind of real claustrophobic brutality of the defense of the gate. Yes. It really feels like it's really, really cramped and very tight. Yeah. Aragorn and Gimli's side mission, he goes, toss me, don't tell the elf. There's some really, really, really good stuff, and Legolas pulling the safety. There's lots of lovely moments as well. There's some levity to these scenes as well. Primarily through Gimli and Legolas, which is in the book. And I think, again, Jackson draws this out without making it hokey. I think it's the tension and the weight of what's happening still resonates, even though you've got Legolas and Gimli kind of having a good time in the fight, you know, getting to, the kill count, you know, and trying to beat each other.
Well, it's true to their characters and true to their races, because there's always been conflict. There's always been a bit of competition between those two races. So having them play up with each other like that, it makes perfect sense within world as well.
Yeah, definitely. What about all the stuff then? We haven't really talked much about Treebeard, really, have we? And Merry and Pippin then. Look at those scenes.
Yeah, well, that kind of falls into my favourite moments as well, because I think it's very important that Merry and Pippin meet Treebeard, and when they, you know, when they kind of get an understanding that, well, you know, I think Merry's, as you said, he's more clocked into the situation. He knows what's going on, whereas Pippin is still a bit oblivious to it all until the thought of the Shire being burnt to the ground by the machinery of war is when he suddenly clicks and he suddenly wakes up. And that moment where he tells Treebeard to go south.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he understands what needs to be done now. He understands that he needs to fight for his little part of the world. And it's a real brilliant character moment for Pippin.
Many of these trees were my friends. Creatures I had known from Nut and Acorn.
I'm sorry, Treebeard.
They had voices of their own. Saruman. A wizard should know better. No! Show the tongues of men for this treachery.
Look, the trees! They're moving!
Where are they going?
They have business with the orcs. My business is with Isengard tonight, with Rockenstone.
I really enjoy the scenes with the Ents. I really enjoy Treebeard. I know a lot of people are just like, oh my God, another Treebeard scene. I love all the stuff with Treebeard. I think he's great. And all the stuff about the Entwives is quite a sad story as well. And then, you know, when you get the March of the Ents. The March of the Ents is one of my favourite moments in the entire trilogy as well.
Again, the music as they march down on Isengard. And it's great. And coupled with all the stuff going on in Helm's Deep, I think... I can see why there was quite a few little cut scenes that are brought back in the extended edition, which happened during the Helm's Deep battle, which were basically Merry and Pippin going, Treebeard, come on, you've got to do something. And I can see why they were cut, because even though they do add some stuff to it, it breaks the pacing a little bit. And I think, you know, maybe it's one thing where maybe that some of the theatrical version of the Helm's Deep may have worked, because it's much, much tighter. But it pays off. And when they march upon Isengard's and Saruman's face suddenly for the first time is on the back foot, and then they break the dam, and it really is nature fighting back, isn't it? And that's what I love about it. And I think one of my favourite moments as well is when the water's breaking into Isengard and that flaming end walks in and just dunks himself in the water to put himself
dunks his
out
head. it's great. It really is a kind of warning to everyone, you know, don't mess around with nature, because it'll bite back, and it'll bite back hard.
Yeah.
It is a good little kind of environmental message that goes through there.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, the climax of Helm's Deep, when Aragorn and Theoden ride out, and then Gandalf appears with him, and that the sunlight breaks the ranks, they charge down the hill, and that music. My notes for Isengard and that scene are just epic. It's just epic. It's amazing.
That hill is obscenely steep.
Yes.
And just the way those horses come down it's just like, it's magnificent. It really is an epic moment.
And I think it's a superb climax to the movie. The way they interweave the stuff going on as Gileath with Faramir and Sam and Frodo and Gollum, and obviously the Black Rider attacking as well, and obviously the Helm's Deep battle and Isengard. It truly is an epic finale, I think. It's very hard to find a film that is at that level, that maintain. We think so much together, but also, you know, delivers. And I think, as we said at the beginning, the fact that actually the climax of the movie is this big ass battle with Shelob, but it's cut till the third movie. You've already lost your big dramatic opening scene with the death of Boromir, and it's still a tightly woven, really fantastic, epic climax as well. And absolutely worked. It feels like this is the natural conclusion of this movie.
Yeah, and if you think about it, if they had left Shelob in there, it would have been a bit of a messy end. There's too much going on. Because you've already got three separate strands of stories going on. And I think having Shelob in there as well would have been too many climaxes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's enough going with Frodo and Sam, you know. Separate side of that, Gollum is amazing. You've got you do introduce Faramir. You see Frodo's slow corruption. You've got things like the Dead Marshes and that. So you've got enough good stuff going on. There isn't masses for Frodo and Sam in this movie to do. You know, some of the Black Gate's quite tense, but maybe they're a little bit poorly served compared with the book. But that comes in the third film, and you know, and that's when they really kind of shine, particularly Sam as well. So
yeah.
So would you talk briefly about some of the extended stuff then before we kind of have final thoughts then? So there was a lot of extended scenes in this movie, or brand new scenes as well. Are there any ones that kind of say stand out for you that we want to draw upon that we haven't talked about?
The only kind of real stuff that stands up to me, kind of compared to the book, is Aemo, who I briefly mentioned, his character is very different. In the book, he forms a real brotherhood with Aragorn, and in the book, he's not banished from the city; he is imprisoned in the city, and then Aragorn and Gandalf get him out, and Aragorn and Aemo kind of form this brotherhood bond, which I'm kind of a bit sad that wasn't included, but a lot of that banishment scene is extended. I think there's bits of it in the film, but it's much more extended.
Yeah, the massacre at the Ford's of Eyes, and that you see Theodred as well. They find out at the Ford as well. And you get also the Wildmen as well. The Wildmen are mentioned in the theatrical version, but you see Saruman send the Wildmen out to attack as well. So I think the one thing as well that opening does very, very well is very expositiony. Again, once you've got past all the stuff with Sam and Frodo, and there's some extended stuff there with the Elven rope and stuff, which is a little bit of extra context, you get Saruman doing a lot of dialogue. You suddenly introduce the Wildmen and all of Rohan, and there's much more than the theatrical version. So many things plates spinning all at once before you even get to Aragorn and Gimli and Legolas charging night and day to find Merry and Pippin. So they do a lot in those opening scenes. The Burning of the Restful and the Massacre of the Ford's of Eyes and the Banishment of Aemo as well, all stuff that is new, but I think it does a very, very good job of kind of keeping the plate spinning without feeling like it's just filling in the blanks for the audience.
Yeah, and the whole night attack of the Uruk-hai with Merry and Pippin's escape, I think pretty much all of that is brand new stuff. I don't think hardly any of that was.
You see little bits of it, but it's definitely a lot longer. Yeah. And a lot more tense as well, that really nasty orc that wants to eat them, and I think the one that follows them into the woods as well. Yeah, it's definitely it's much more tense. Yeah, it gives them more to do. There's a lot of stuff with the Ents. There's some of the Ent wives and a lot of stuff later on, which you mentioned, is probably cut for that. The one thing that was cut from the end of the theatrical version, which plays out in the extended version, is the arrest of Fangorn going to Helm's Deep. So you see a little bit of the march down, the forest marches off, and then the orcs, the orcs escape. So they aren't actually wiped out by the horsemen, some of them escape, about 100 of them escape, and they go into this forest, and suddenly it's like a massacre, and you all hear these wailing screams as well. I really like that. I'm glad the extended version had that.
Yeah. The scene where Merry and Pippin drink the Ent draft is also a brand new scene. Again, it's not needed, but it's a great fun scene because it takes the mickey out of like their height or their height difference. So that was quite good fun.
Yeah. And again, as well, a lot like the Fellowship, actually, there's a lot more stuff with Aragorn that was kind of cut. There's the scene when Eowyn finds out he's one of the Dunedain and he's 87 years old. So that kind of... he plays a good 87-year-old, I think.
My favourite bit in that scene is the fact that her stew is obviously disgusting.
It looks revolting.
Yeah, and he's trying to pour it away, and she turns around, and he kind of gets it back up again really quickly and spills a bit on him. It's really funny, the painting on the page,
that's great. Yeah, there's some really good stuff with him, and the scene with Brego as well, which I can see why it was cut, but I think the Brego season later on, it kind of has a bit more resonance. Yeah. And there's Saruman learning that he also does hair through Wormtongue with the ring as well. There's lots of stuff that, again, flesh out Aragorn's character. Because I think I can see why they were cut in both Fellowship and Two Towers. But when you look at Return of the King, the king is Aragorn. Aragorn becomes the key player in a third movie. And because a lot of these scenes were cut from the theatrical version, I don't know, because I know the book so well. When it came to the films, I knew where Aragorn's story was leading. I don't know if maybe it would have resonated as much for casual viewers in the theatrical versions, because a lot of the stuff that develops Aragorn's character are through these cut scenes in both the first two movies. So I really appreciate them, because they really add flesh out Aragorn's character, because he is really, really important, even though he's very much like just a key member of the ensemble, really. Towards the end of this movie, in Two Towers of Helm's Deep, he does step up, absolutely. But I think that's when he kind of really steps into this limelight. Is when he opens those doors, the heroic moment, and steps in. But yeah, there's definitely some really, really good stuff with Aragorn there. They seem to be the kind of the main scenes that I think really flesh out. But a lot of stuff's been extended in this movie as well, and a lot of scenes that kind of just add more context and more flavour to the world as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key the key kind of character arc for Aragorn in the Two Towers is the fact that he is accepting his fate as the king of Gondor. His relationship with Theoden is very important in that evolution of his character, not only for Aragorn but Aragorn for Theoden, and reminding Theoden that he is king and that he must stand up and protect the people. So it's a very important character arc for Aragorn. So any of those extra bits that the extended edition gives just gives more depth to that character arc.
Absolutely, yeah. So kind of final question then, who's the most valuable player in the entire Two Towers film?
MVP?
Yeah.
It has to be Sam, because if Frodo gets the ring stolen from him by Gollum, or if he, if he hasn't got Sam to keep him centred, to keep that nasty side, the ring side of Frodo taken over, there's no point to anyone else doing anything. So I think it has to be Sam. I think Sam's the MVP for the entire trilogy, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, not so clear in the first one, but in the end. But yeah, this is where he really steps up.
And definitely third, definitely.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. No, I agree. And arguably as well as Gollum, because Gollum represents that struggle with Frodo has himself, and kind of it reflects that as well, definitely. Cool. Any final thoughts then? I don't know, we probably could talk for another 6 hours on this, but maybe there is a 10-hour version. Apparently there are 20 hours of footage of Helm's Deep, so maybe there is a 10-hour version out there that you can watch. But any final thoughts on Two Towers before we wrap up then?
It's just a great middle chapter of this trilogy, and I think it stands up there with Empire Strikes Back as the best of the trilogy, for me at least. I just find it absolutely wonderful. I love the Rohan. I love King Theoden. I love the whole evolution of Gollum and Frodo and where they're going. It's just everything's kind of building up to the Return of the King, which I am simultaneously looking forward to talking about and not talking about, because there's a lot of emotional attachment to the Return of the King. So it's going to be an interesting one to talk about. So, but yeah, I'm ready for film three, I think.
Fantastic, brilliant, yeah, absolutely. I think Fellowship rings, but the Fellowship wins by hair's breadth. For me, I think it's a tighter film, but the final act of the Two Towers is the best act of any Lord of the Rings movie. I think it's just so well done. As much as I adore a lot of the Return of the King, there's so much going on, really. Kind of it's just epic on epic on epic. But I think it's a really singular focus to the Helm's Deep and Isengard kind of stuff in this, which is just absolutely astounding every single time. You know, I was watching yesterday. I know this film backwards, and I'm still having a great time every single time. Yeah.
100%.
Brilliant. So that comes to the end of our discussion on the Two Towers. We'll be back next month to talk The Return of the King. And then in September, we'll be kicking off a weekly look back at The Rings of Power as well. So really looking forward to delving into the TV series and see where that holds up.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the TV series now, and kind of watching back of these is making me more hungry for more Middle Earth.
Definitely, yeah. Where can we find you online if people want to talk Lord of the Rings or anything else with you?
The best place to find me is two places. You can find me on the We Made This podcast networks from my various podcasts, or you can find me at lukewinch.com, which also has links to my podcast, but also a link to my book blog, which is the SFF book blog, where I review science fiction and fantasy novels. And I also have a podcast attached to that with the We Made This network called Turn of a Page, where I chat to book bloggers, booktubers, authors, and everything book culture, basically. So you can find that as well, and that's in full swing now, and we've got lots of really great interviews coming up.
Fab, yes. And you can find me on Twitter at Baz Greenland, where I post all my books that I write, and obviously all podcasts as well. Luke and I, we obviously host a Babylon 5 podcast, which is the other thing very close to our hearts. So A Dream Given Form, which has been going strong now for a few months. And I've also got my own podcast, A TARDIS Crew, which is a .2 podcast I host with my son Ben as well. And you can find us on Twitter at One Rules Them All. So thanks for joining us for another episode. And remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to One Rules More and give us a rating review on our podcast. We'd really, really like to hear your thoughts on, and hopefully you enjoy what we're putting out so far. The Lord of the Rings is not all we're discussing, so we'll give you a taste of what else you might have missed on the network in a moment. We'll be back next month to look at the final chapter in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, The Return of the King. Until then, remember, even the smallest person can change the course of the future.
elsewhere on We Made This.
The TARDIS Crew, a Doctor Who podcast.
Half of your audience punches the air and goes, yeah, he's going to do it. And the other half goes, that pretentious moron. I'm going to go with Ghostlight. It has to be Ghost. Ghostlight is the episode of the Cartmel McCoy era that, like, most embodies absolutely everything that I love about this era today.
Yeah, it's a big story, and it's a bit of a decisive as well. Yeah, is it brilliant? Is it pretentious? Is it both? I mean, that's what I love about Ghostlight.
Does it make any sense? That's the question.
I genuinely did not expect that answer, so I thought you were just going to be really normy and go Remembrance or Fenric or something, and then I hear Ghostlight, I'm like, yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly probably the most unique story of the era.
Pick a disc.
From a sort of Japanese perspective, he has sort of what you would consider in America as like almost like an Old West vibe. It's not, you know, one-to-one because Old West is kind of hokey, but it's all of these musical styles like enka and like piano jazz, like piano bar, piano lounge jazz, that are sort of reminiscent of like gangsters or like old type, like old-timey yakuza or old politician types. And so it kind of like evokes that vibe. And if you watch any amount of Japanese film that wants to be overt about, you know, its characters, you'll kind of see those themes like reappearing.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
This does have another one of my favorite lines, and I'm pretty sure you can both guess what it is. You want to squeeze my buttocks together to make one juicy giant peach. And I have never been brave enough to squeeze anyone's buttocks together to make a juicy giant peach. Have either of you ever squeezed someone's buttock together to make a juicy giant peach?
No.
No comment.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.